Morning again. So we are in the middle of Romans chapter 8, which is in many ways the climactic chapter, that's hard to say for me, of the book of Romans, which is, again, the magnum opus of St. Paul. And you kind of get that sense because he's pulling together so many different threads and stories from Israel's deep past, and the moment of Jesus being revealed to humanity and what he accomplished, and he's pulling all of that together and looking ahead in a way that he doesn't really do in any other book. And now, naturally, because it's St. Paul, that means it's very, very complicated. Paul is the type of person who will speak like two-thirds of a sentence, and then his brain will kind of jump to the next thing, and then he'll speak two-thirds of the next thought, and then go back, and then jump way, you know, ahead. I take medication to help me with that. I guess they didn't have that back then. But anyway, I only say that because if you find yourself going, I'm missing something here, that's probably why. You're in good company. Well, you're at least in company. I don't know if I'd say good. Now, in the beginning, or in the first verse of our reading today, it sounds like Paul is getting very, very personal when he says that the suffering now is not worth being compared to the glory that is to be revealed. And we naturally, and a lot, I think a lot of it is sort of our culture, where we grew up, and just the modern era, we tend to think of that as individual hope. As though Jesus came to earth to come up next to us and say, every little thing is going to be all right. Now, that was Bob Marley, not Jesus. That came to me last night in a vision. And what we're going to see is that's actually not what Paul means. And then we're going to tease out a little bit of what he does mean as he talks about creation itself groaning. And then we'll see that that is actually what Paul means. And he's doing something there on purpose. So again, he connects everything that he has talked about before that, where he is pulling together the community of Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians in Rome that had been separated for maybe a decade, we're not totally sure, and trying to encourage them to come back together after they were forced to live apart for quite some time. And he does that by telling the story of God interacting with humanity and essentially demonstrating that both those with a Jewish background and those with a Gentile background are not so different. In fact, they're all broken and in need of something that they cannot do for themselves. And to shock everyone, or not even at all, it all begins with the covenant or the promise that God made with Abraham, that he will be their God, he and his descendants will be their people, and through him and through that line, the whole world will be blessed, and lo and behold, that blessing has come, that by sending Jesus, God demonstrated that he was ultimately faithful to the promise that he made. That is one of the most important themes of Paul that ends up getting missed in all of his writings, that God has been infinitely faithful, even when he is people or not. And we can make that very personal. God has been infinitely faithful, even when you have not, and when I have not. That's a very, very solid promise. So as he then moves into chapters 6 and 7, he demonstrates that we have this problem, that God has given these requirements or expectations really for what it means to be human in the best sense. And the problem isn't just that he gave us a set of rules and we broke four of them. The problem is that something has gone so wrong with humanity that when we even set our own standards for ourselves, we can't live up to them. We inevitably break them. And so the presence of laws, of standards, of expectations has a tendency to bring death. In fact, it's not even just a tendency, that's just what it does. That doesn't mean it's bad. That means that something in the system is broken. That part of that is broken is me, by the way. And as a result, in what Jesus has done, in his death and his resurrection, he has created an avenue of connection with that moment. And that is what baptism is. We are buried with Jesus in baptism. And as Paul explains, that death that we die with Jesus releases us from the bonds of the law. And that should be obvious. Like, the United States has lots of laws. Albuquerque seems to have fewer laws. It is what it is. But nonetheless, I think we can all agree that once you're dead, the law no longer applies. And that's the point that Paul makes. However, when Jesus brings death, he always brings life. And so when he's raised from the dead, he conquers death. And as a result, you are now no longer under any condemnation, even when it was your fault, plainly and clearly your fault. Kind of a, not God forgive them for they don't know what they're doing. It's more like, God forgive me, I know exactly what I'm doing. And therefore, as Paul begins in chapter 8, there is no condemnation for those who are buried or who are in Jesus. Now, as he makes his way then verse 18 and beyond, he starts connecting that with the suffering and the struggle, the groaning that we as people experience in the moment. I don't know a single person whose house is not touched by suffering. And I will say this, just as a pastor and just with a brain that's kind of wired to notice patterns and make connections, our community, Christ Lutheran, I want to say for the last 9 months, give or take, has seen a lot more tragedy and suffering than usual. And I don't know what that's about. It's probably just a coincidence. I'm not interested in making any meaning of it. But I've noticed that over the last 9 months, there are more people that are just struggling in all kinds of ways than I think is normal. And I don't know what else to make of that other than things are really hard right now. And that it just is what it is. And so as a result, Paul then says, you know, the suffering we now experience pales in comparison to what's coming. But then that leads us to the question of what's coming. And then Paul seems to just take a left turn. He suddenly starts talking about creation, and creation as the world, as the cosmos, subjected to futility. Something has gone wrong in creation. And by that, it's a little tricky to figure out what it means, because I think he generally just means everything. That there is this order, this establishment that God has put in place. And whether it's nature itself or human civilization, society, families, relationships between a couple of people, whatever, something has gone horribly wrong. And as a result, the fundamental nature of existence is just shaking and groaning and waiting for relief. This is why I said that the beginning of our reading today is not really meant initially to be individualistic. It's more holistic. It's human society, human beings as a race, people living in creation that in which God has placed them. Now, to get to that, and we will go very, very quickly through this because we could camp there all day, it actually goes back to the beginning, to the book of Genesis, where we have two creation narratives, and one of the most important moments is when God says, "Let us make humankind in our image." And image bearing is one of those weird fundamental themes in the Bible that only gets mentioned a couple of times. I think the idea is that it's just assumed that we understand that. The problem is that as modern people, we don't. We tend to think of being made in the image of God as kind of a fundamental dignity or worth as in terms of being human. That's not wrong, but that's not exactly what it means. I know in the medieval era it meant that, well, we have this rational soul, whatever that means, our ability to think and reason. Some would say that it's our ability and our natural inclination to create. I think that's getting a little closer. But in the world in which that was written, it actually had a pretty simple meaning. It means that you represent God. That's all it is. In other ancient Near Eastern civilizations in which Israel lived, it meant literally the statue of a god in a temple, which means the earth was created to be God's temple. We are made to be a living, breathing, moving statue or representative or representation of God. Another analogy you could draw is we were meant to be his ambassadors. And the problem comes when we no longer represent the interests, wisdom, grace that God possesses. And that's the fall. And once that happens, things just fall apart. And so if you kind of listen very carefully to what Paul is saying, like creation has been suffering since that moment and it has been waiting. Now, the image-bearingness, which is a word I just made up, of human beings isn't necessarily lost, but it has been corrupted. And there's always been this inclination, this desire for something that is good and true and beautiful. And at times, we've been able to name it, and at other times, we have not. I'll give you an example. I'm technically on vacation right now. I came out of retirement or vacation or whatever for a day because we have our annual congregational meeting where we pass the budget. That's not something I can miss. But next week, as part of that vacation, my family is going to get to go to a wolf encounter, like an actual wolf encounter. And apparently, we can get up close and personal with them. And I'm fighting the temptation to find a way to slip some ham into my brother's pocket just to see, you know, like he'll probably be okay. We'll see. But, you know, and I'm looking forward to that, of course, and I'm thinking, like, what a weird thing for humans to do. Wolves are like apex predators. Why would we cut them a break? Or something maybe a little closer to where I grew up. Sharks. Sharks are scary. Now, to be fair, shark attacks are exceedingly rare. Way more rare than you'd think. In fact, vending machines kill more people on average per year than sharks do. Look that up, by the way. It is true. And yet, there are sanctuaries for sharks. There are like places for rehabilitation and population growth, or to encourage population growth amongst sharks. Why would we do that? Sharks are really scary. They bite, and they have teeth. What would drive humans to care about the things that will try to eat them? Now, there's a lot of ways we can answer that, but I think fundamentally underneath all of that, we would recognize it's good for the environment, predators are needed, and as a result, it's just the right thing to do. There's no other animal that would even attempt to do that, because they would just get eaten. And I think one of the things that shows is this natural, normal human inclination, in the best sense of the word, to preserve and care for the creation around us. Earth, in fact, is our home. And even though we live in a whole lot of brokenness and it feels like everything is on fire, literally and metaphorically right now, some of that goodness is still there. But when the image bearers, those who are given charge to take care of all of creation, and you are part of creation, that in our brokenness, that creation waits for a moment that has not happened yet. When we are restored as human beings to live as human in the truly best sense of the word, at which point creation, in the words of Paul, will breathe a sigh of relief. Because in Jesus, the caretakers, you and me, will be put back together. We will actually reflect the grace and wisdom of God. Now, there is a lot that can be funneled into that idea. Because this does not just mean care for the environment, although that is a good thing. Or to put it another way, being wise stewards or caretakers of the resources God has given us. Sometimes we do that well, sometimes we don't. But it isn't just that. Because like I said a few minutes ago, you are part of creation. I hope that shouldn't be controversial. And we as human beings are likewise given an immense amount of power and control, even over the people around us. By way of example, I have never seen or met anybody that has more power and control over the people around them than I have in a 3-week-old infant. You really think you're in charge of the world? Have a kid. It's worth it, but it's not easy. And if an infant can control his or her environment just by screaming, as we get older, we just get better and maybe a little more able to manipulate around us. And that can be really, really hard. I don't know if you've noticed this, but people also have a tendency to irritate each other. Living in relationship with anybody will have challenges. Living as a society, living as a culture, living within a community is a challenge. Living within a church community where theoretically we have kind of a leg up on things is still really, really hard. For now, what began in Jesus, and therefore what we receive now, is, as Paul says, the first fruits. It's just the beginning of what will eventually be the reality for all of us in creation. Now, what does that mean? Well, one of the hallmarks, one of the things that the way of Jesus brings that is especially at the time and really in general still true, truly unique, is the notion of forgiveness. That was a very strange idea when Jesus hit the scene. It still can be a very strange idea now. The idea that I could harm somebody, even willingly, and in the name of Jesus, that person can turn to me and say, you know what you did was not okay, but I'm not going to hold it against you anymore. You're free from that. That is a beautiful thing. It is a rare thing to be done truly and fully in with a pure heart. But that's just the first fruit. It's just the beginning. There are other signs and markers that Paul has already talked about in Romans, where we as human beings feel this feel this crushing weight of expectation and failure. Many of us live with, actually I would say basically all of us, and if you don't, that signals something else is going wrong, have at least some sense of shame, regret. And shame on the, there are certain kinds of shame actually can be a good thing. It just sort of keeps everything from descending into chaos. But it's the shame that sneaks into your head that tells you that you, in fact, are awful. Not you did an awful thing, but you are, in fact, awful. It's a character judgment. The voice of shame will point out your flaws and say that that is who you are. Sometimes the voice of shame sounds like people we've known. If you grew up in a really toxic family, it's going to sound like your parents, just by way of example. If you grew up with undiagnosed ADHD and you were just kind of a mess as a kid, it's going to sound like your teachers. Ask me how I know. And the beginning, the first fruits, as Paul sees it, in this upstart community that is living in the way of Jesus in the city of Rome in roughly the early 60s AD, is to say, you know what, the voices of shame that try to tell me who I am are a lie. The ways that people have tried to grind me into dust, even if they meant well, those voices were a lie. We are no longer defined by those. And instead, we are defined by the one who came and died in our place. And as a result, defeated death within us. But this is just the beginning. With Jesus, to quote Jonathan Edwards, the best is always yet to come. And if that is our reality and that is our promise, then when Paul says that the suffering and struggle we experience now will pale in comparison to the glory that's to be revealed. Well, first off, he is talking about this big global picture, this big picture of humanity restored and ruling over creation in God's wisdom and grace. But I can't help but notice that that's also really, really good news now. Because it comes with the promise that whatever suffering and struggle you experience now, and again, I don't know why or what's going on, but it just seems really heightened right now within our community. A lot of people are hurting in many different ways. It speaks to that moment as well. That there will come a time when the true, redeemed, fully alive, and resurrected children of God rule over a restored creation, at which point we will realize that God was telling a story of redemption in our pain and suffering. We just didn't know it. We did not have the eyes to see it. But we still have the promise that it's happening. Amen. As you are able, please rise.